Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Is it time for talks to end hostilities in Ukraine? Well, more and more so-called Russia experts seem to think so. The fundamental question that first must be asked, who should be doing the talking? The people who lied Ukraine into conflict and divided the world? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, Martin Jay in Marrakesh. He's an award-winning journalist and commentator. And in Budapest, we cross to George Samueli. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out with George in Budapest. George, you suggested that we discuss the foreign affairs issue that came out on July 13th of this year with the a group of articles under the rubric of Should Ukraine Negotiate with Russia, which is a very interesting title, but none of the articles actually addressed that issue. Okay, I found it to be really interesting, but unremarkable that all of these articles, they go in an orbit around the core issue of regime change in Russia. Security was not mentioned whatsoever. Pan-European security was not mentioned. Amazingly, no context whatsoever. The Minsk process was mentioned once, but incorrectly. It was not contextualized. The illegal overthrow of power in Kiev in 2014 was not mentioned whatsoever. But of course, Russia breaks all of its agreements. But no mention of what Angela Merkel had to say or Hollande about the Minsk process. Nothing. No context whatsoever. And this is supposed to be the collected, distilled wisdom of foreign policy establishment in the United States, foreign affairs. Take it away, George.
You're absolutely spot on, Peter. Well, the original article that triggered this symposium at Foreign Affairs had, in a somewhat tentative, insipid way, suggested that, well, this war has reached a stalemate, so it's time for some kind of a negotiated outcome. But the original author suggested an armistice, and the model that he suggested was a Korean armistice, and that the peace lasted for 70 years there. Now, the response, as you said, of these foreign affairs maven was absolute outrage. This is how can we possibly talk with Russia? And as you say, because it's broken all its agreements and we can't possibly trust them. And besides, Ukraine is winning this war. Just give them a little bit more and keep giving them more and Ukraine will win. And Prigozhin, 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 Prigozhin. And, I don't know how many times, I think I counted about 12 times the name Prigozhin came up, even though it doesn't in any way prove their point, because, first of all, the coup, obviously, or the mutiny wasn't successful. And second of all, if it had been successful, that would have been even worse for any prospect of a negotiated outcome. But at the same time, you can see why they are so outraged at the prospect of negotiations, because ultimately Ukraine cannot win this war. I mean, it's obvious that Ukraine cannot defeat Russia. It's just mathematically impossible. Strategically impossible. So, and the foreign policy establishment knows this. Now, then they have two conclusions to draw. If their boy cannot win this war, then you can either say, enough already, let's bring this to an end, this madness to an end. So many people have already died. What's the point of just sending more young men into the meat grinder? Or, NATO can take over the fighting from Ukraine and say, okay, we're going to do it. You can't do it. We'll take on Russia. Now, NATO has clearly said that they don't want to do that, and especially they said it at the Vilnius summit. Ukraine can't come in because we don't want to go to war with Russia. We don't want World War III. Well, if you concluded that, then essentially, what do you have? You have to admit that your policy has failed. This whole thing has been an absolute failure. And then you should have taken the deal that was available months and months ago, a year ago, indeed.
That's absolutely it. They cannot admit Martin. They can't admit that this has been a failure. And I'd be remiss not to just mention what George just said here. There was a peace process in Istanbul weeks after the conflict started. And Foreign Affairs actually reported it months after the actual events, as if it was like breaking news, which all of us had been talking about in real time when it was happening. So if the Russians and the Ukrainians were negotiating, the Ukrainians were appeared to be in agreement, and then Boris Johnson shows up to collapse these talks here. But so the Ukrainians thought they could deal with the Russians in good faith to get an agreement. It was the West that thought otherwise. Martin.
It does come down to who we negotiate with, I think. And I have to seriously doubt whether Zelensky is the man. I said on Russian TV, RT, just a few days ago on a news program that I think maybe in 6 months' time, he may not even be there. Zelensky is not the man to do it. He's just like the West, like his Western puppets. He seems to be stuck in this cocoon of indulgent narrative nonsense whereby, you know, he can't see anything clearly. And these articles that you and George are alluding to, the Foreign Affairs piece, which is quite well written, I must say, but was very, very paternalistic. And, you know, very delusional about the role of the West. And there was this undertone which kept coming through, which made me chuckle as I read it, which was this thing about values, which was the West always had the higher ground. And it had this moral tutelage, which it needed to deliver to such mere mortals like the Russian people, you know, who were sort of second rate people. And Putin was a sort of third rate leader. You know, there was a reference in the article to we can't have peace talks until Russia sort of gives up its aggressive policies around the world and returns to the table of responsible nations. Now think about that phrase, responsible nations. You're giggling already, because I know what you're thinking and I know what George is thinking. Responsible nations, would these be the same responsible nations that marched into Baghdad in 2003 and nicked all Saddam Hussein's gold on the first day? And then refused to pick up the tab of paying all of his soldiers back pay, which then resulted in them creating what we now know today, an organization called ISIS. Were those responsible nations the same ones who went into Afghanistan for 20 years and left the country in a worse state than what it was when they went in and actually, you know, crystallized and the Taliban and made them a bigger, more powerful
power? Isn't that really the But that's really the point. I'm glad Martin brought this up. I mean, these articles, okay, they're well written. Okay, and they finally got an editor to smooth out their prose. That's fine with me. It makes it easier to read. But George, it's a moral argument, and this is not a moral issue. This is a security issue. And again, when you look at the distilling down all of this verbiage right here. Russia, it is not recognized that Russia has legitimate security interests. That's why this conflict happened, and that's why it's going to be very difficult to resolve, because up and until then, if they don't recognize Russia's security interests, Russia has no interest in talking. Full stop.
No, that's absolutely right. And Martin brings up Iraq. And yes, the assumption underlying all of these articles is that there is indeed this cadre of responsible nations acting seriously, judiciously, responsibly, weighing their decisions, and that Russia, on the other hand, is just a wild savage on the world stage, has no idea how to do anything in the proper fashion. And of course, it's the exact opposite of the truth. But yes, they don't recognize that Russia has security interests. All of the articles only focus on Ukraine's security interests. But the reason we got here was precisely because that Russia outlined its security issues and has been doing so for years and years and years. I mean, we go back to 2007 and Putin's Munich Security Conference speech. 2008, Putin angrily responded to that to the NATO invitation for Ukraine to join the organization. He made clear there that Russia is not going to just accept it. And over again, Russia repeated this point. This is a threat to our security. And then when in 2014, this rabidly Russophobic regime seized power. The people who had actually lost the election in 2010, they were now in power. First thing they did was, first of all, they passed the new language law, essentially outlawing Russian as an official language in certain parts of Ukraine. But they also moved immediately to overturn the predecessor Yanukovych's policy and move into NATO. All of the Russians were bound to respond with great suspicion. And we know that if it had been the other way, the Americans wouldn't have hesitated. They would not have hesitated the years and years that Russia hesitated before moving in. Because Mexico, we know there was some anti-American government would have seized power and made clear that it's now going to join a rival, hostile military alliance. The Americans would have moved into Mexico City within days. They would have seized the Mexican leader, bundled him off in a plane in Florida, and put him on trial. They would have put him on trial and sentenced him to life imprisonment, as they did with Noriega. There wouldn't have been any hesitation. And the media would have been clapping and said, absolutely, America's absolutely justified about the security threat. But yeah, in this world of foreign affairs, they've kind of created this absolute delusional international situation.
It was even, there was a very short reference. And I'm talking about the corpus. I mean, it takes a while to read these articles, but one reference, I think, was Angela Stint, you know, Russia's security proposals before the conflict started, the December before, just completely dismissed. I mean, but this was made transparently clear. There will be consequences if there is not negotiations on these issues. And so, again, you can't trust the Russians, but you can't trust the West, even when they're given a set of agreements they may not upfront agree with, but saying, well, that's a starting point. Isn't that what the point of all these articles is where is the starting point? We had one before the conflict started.
Yeah, but George nailed it when he used the word delusional. And that's absolutely true. There's so much going on. What's going on now in the West is just, there's so much delusion. There's so much writing. And the narrative, which is written by people who are just blinded by their own dogma, who can't see anything straight. I think a point was made just a few days ago on British television that all we seem to see on British TV news is, you know, the few victories that Ukrainians might have, isolated victories, are sort of reported on too much, and of course the failures are not reported on at all. And you know, and this sort of way of reporting on the events on the ground, I think, has fed into how these very highbrow opinion writers come about when they open their laptops up and start writing this delusional garbage. I mean, you know, the articles I found to be very, very paternalistic. And I think there is this idea, which is very common in America, which is that...
Hold that idea, Martin. We're going to go to a hard break. And after that hard break, Martin is going to give us a very good hard idea. Stay with RT.
March the 11th, 2011. The largest earthquake ever recorded in Japan is registered. A 14-meter tsunami devastates the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant.
Sono nel centro di Tokyo, da Kasaka. C'è un terremoto fortissimo, tutti i palazzi stanno muovendosi.
The nuclear reactors are flooded, sparking an horrific disaster. Pio, an Italian journalist living in Japan, decides to go to the area of the nuclear meltdown in Fukushima immediately.
Non è arrivato ancora nessuno delle autorità. Sono passati tre giorni. Ecco, questa è la situazione di questo.
Ecco, siamo arrivati a 2 chilometri dalla centrale di Fukushima, quella che sta facendo preoccupare il Giappone e tutto il resto del mondo.
A 4-year investigation starts. Watch on RT.
I think Ukraine does exist, should exist, and it is precisely the best option, I suspect, for its future is to find that amalgam of the cultures that are within it and turn it into something unique and flourishing that that would define it in distinction, but not conflict, but simply the difference between itself and its neighbors.
Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. This is the home edition. To remind you, we're discussing Ukraine. Okay, we're back from the break. Martin, you wanted to bring up an important point, and now you're going to. Go ahead.
It is that simply that there is this belief by elites, the Western elites, that we don't have total unity when it comes to joined up thinking about Ukraine. You know, that there is, NATO is divided, certainly within Europe, you know, and the author makes the reference to, you know, we had that unity in Syria and in Afghanistan. And in Yugoslavia. And these are interesting points to make because, you know, if you look at it, it's very tempting to say, well, you had the unity in Yugoslavia because you created a false flag attack in Sarajevo market in the summer of 1995, which then led Clinton to go ahead with NATO airstrikes, you know, and Afghanistan was also completely fictitious based on principles of why we went to war there in the first place. And Syria, we are stealing oil from the Syrians every single day. You know, how can these be morals? How can these be the high moral ground? We had unity in those countries, but we don't have unity in Ukraine. You know, no, I think we need to step back from all this and look at what happened in Vilnius last week. You know, there was, to me, I saw an oil tanker just floating in the ocean with no rudder. And if a picture paints 1,000 words, look at that photograph of Zelensky standing in the middle there on his own, isolated. Nobody wants to talk to him in his stupid green fatigues, which make him look like some, I don't know, porn movie extra, you know.
Well, he looked like a mini Idi Amin to me.
Yeah, something like that, but lost. You know, and you know,
but that's exactly what it is. I mean, he doesn't have agency. George, that's another one of these things, issues in these articles, is that only Ukraine can decide. Well, how can Ukraine decide if it has no agency whatsoever? And apparently, as a result of the Istanbul process, they were exerting their agency and they were denied it. And now they're more captive now than ever before. So again, this fiction, this mythology that they're putting, nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine. Well, the more you think about that, the more Ukraine's going to disappear. George.
Yes, no, exactly. And that's why it's so disgusting. I mean, you read these articles and you're filled with this disgust, because they insist, well, Ukraine can win this war. All it needs is more ammo, more weapons, and then Ukraine is going to win this war, which, of course, then raises the question, well, if Ukraine is so strong and can take the Russians on by themselves, why are you so insistent that it has to be in NATO? I mean, you know, why does it need these Article 5 guarantees if it can just whip Russia if it feels like it? And, of course, Given that they now are committed to this idea that, well, you know, we've got to do it because, you know, the longer this war goes on, the more likely it is that Putin will be overthrown and then we'll have this wonderful government, you know, who's this wonderful government? Oh, Prigozhin. but ultimately, it's a deep, why it's disgusting is that it's deeply immoral. I mean, you're not doing the fighting. Angela Stent, you know, she has a nice gig in I think Georgetown University. All of them having, live, you know, high on the hog. They're not doing the dying. So essentially, they're just recommending this continuing policy, which is only going to lead to more and more death, and then to an agreement that is going to be far worse for their purported client than that they could have got now. Or more than a year ago. I mean, there was the Istanbul agreement was a pretty good agreement. I think far more than Ukraine deserved, but it was a good agreement.
And I'm glad that George brought that up, because put this into perspective, everyone. Wrap your head around the following. The Istanbul process that looked like it had come to fruition up until the last second, the Kiev regime was being asked to give up what it didn't have. That is a pretty good deal. Martin, in my introduction, I mentioned who should do the talking. Well, the people that wrote these articles for Foreign Affairs, these are the people that crafted this policy in the first place. These are the last people you should be asking advice to or going to for wisdom, because they certainly don't have either.
I don't know. I can't see how we break forward, how we move forward on anything. We talk about an armistice and the North Korean model, and the authors outline so many reasons why that can't happen. I think probably an armistice of some sort will happen unofficially. I think that's probably the most likely scenario of the next 6 months. You know, but it won't be Zelensky who brokers that. He's just too stuck in this mindset of, if we talk peace, we have to have a piece of this and you have to give up a piece of that. And that's just not the way forward. That's a dead end from day one.
Let me propose to both of you, if we're going to use this word armistice, there's the only possible way, and I'm going to address this to both of you, is that could happen, is that NATO has to leave Ukraine. And Ukraine, what is left of it, must be neutral and demilitarized. That kind of armistice might work. George?
Well, it might work, but the problem is that NATO has now committed itself to the policy that Ukraine will be in NATO. Well, given that view, then Russia has no incentive to stop until it's pretty much demolished whatever is left of Ukraine, so that they'll just be a landlocked, Trump state, denuded of people, and say, okay, you want Ukraine in NATO? Fine, this is what you can get. Okay, bring it in, give it the Article 5 commitments, but we're gonna take everything. We're gonna take everything that's valuable in Ukraine. That's NATO's doing. NATO has now, hasn't offered any incentives at all for Russia. And that's why NATO, yeah, we will win this war. They don't quite explain how they're gonna win this war. And then after we've won this war, Ukraine will be inducted into NATO. Well, how are any of these things are going to be achieved if you're also making sure that you yourself are not gonna get into the fighting, because hey, you don't wanna get killed and you don't wanna start World War III. So it's an absurd position, but that's it. And that's what's so striking about these foreign affairs writers, is that they've all wedded to this view. This is the Biden administration view. This is the NATO view, the British government view. We'll just keep on fighting in the hope that, I don't know, some miracle is going to happen in Moscow. And then we can celebrate.
That's just the point. That's just the point. And all of these articles revolve around reform, new leader, a liberal leader, a new leader that will swear off imperialist designs. I mean, this is all fantasy. States don't, foreign policy, geopolitics doesn't work that way. And again, you know, as long as, you know, you're focused on regime change and not thinking about security, they've put themselves into a cul-de-sac. I mean, it was really reading these articles was very embarrassing because it was so devoid from reality. Mark?
Yeah, and the reality is that, and Biden has said this, we're running out of ammo. And when he said that, nobody rushed in to say, yes, but we're going to very, very quickly change that situation and restock the Ukrainians. You know, whatever they're going to get in 6 months isn't going to be anywhere near what they were having before. And I think people like Zelensky know that things aren't looking very good at all. And this is one of the reasons.
I'm sorry, Martin, but I think he, at this point, Zelensky and his circle, they're in for the grift, and keep the grift going as long as possible. There's ample evidence that there are plenty of people that have stuffed their money abroad. They've invested
in state. No,
I mean, they're ready for this. I mean, if the fools in the West want to keep funding it, you know, okay, fine, okay.
But the signs are there that Western elites are finally getting tired of this guy. Look at the comments from Ben Wallace. Look at the comments from Biden. Both use this word, you know, lack of gratitude. You know, what they were indicating, what they were hinting was, we've put so much into this and we are paying the political price now back at home. You know, Germany is almost a collapsed economy.
Tell everybody what's happening with Ben Wallace. Yeah. Ben Wallace is one of the first victims of this.
He's a bitter old man because he didn't get the NATO Secretary General job. And now, just a couple of days ago, he's announced to the press that he's chucking in politics and doing God knows what. It's all very, very childish and very petulant stuff. But that is another story we should do another day. You know, the corruption of NATO. What's going on with NATO, with the NATO boss job? You know, I'm sure that Biden has chosen Ursula von der Leyen of the European Commission because she's presented herself. He wants a woman. He wants somebody from Germany would be great. You know, her term is up in the European Commission in about 12 months' time. So it all works. It all fits very neatly and nicely.
Yeah, but I mean, if I could interrupt here and ask her, what was her history as Minister of Defense in Germany?
Nothing, zero. And you ask any German that, they just go, I don't know. You know, because until when she was minister, that was the golden period in German politics where, you know, the defense side of the Ministry of Defense was basically, you know, the most remedial, unspoke of, insignificant government ministry there was.
I think in the German media, it was called the most unloved position in the government here. Hang on, let me go to George. We're rapidly running out of time, as always here. But you know, you bring up probably the most important point here is that NATO is doubling down on future Ukraine membership. So why shouldn't Russia double down on its position that it will never be a member of NATO? 50-50, George.
No, exactly. That has to be NATO's, Russia's position, because you know, having, you know, basically laid down its marker that it cannot accept Ukraine in NATO, and NATO insists that no, Ukraine will be in NATO, then Russia has no incentive at all to negotiate anything. And it's clear that the Western powers haven't done anything. They haven't done the minimum of putting out some kind of peace feelers, some basis for anything. And instead, that's why we have all this propaganda saying, oh, Russia, it doesn't want to negotiate. Russia's not ready for negotiation. And instead, you know, NATO just keeps saying, well, we're going to pour more and more arms into Ukraine, because that'll improve our negotiating position. What negotiating position? You're not negotiating. You haven't put forward in any plan, any proposal. So, well, we'll get a better negotiating position. But of course, that's in itself is a lie, because if you know, the moment Ukraine gets anything, it captures a couple of villages, right away say, hey, we're winning. Let's keep sending more and more, because it's going to put us into another, even better.
Next stop, Moscow.
It's like a gambler, you know, he could never stop. You know, hey, you know, maybe on the next bet, I'm gonna make a fortune. I mean, that's essentially the gambler's policy. This is NATO.
One of my favorite novels, The Gambler. All right, gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Budapest and in Marrakesh. And I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.